It's a narrow bridge of land in Central America that connects north and south. But despite its size, the 82-kilometer artificial waterway known as the Panama Canal makes the Republic of Panama a crucial point for international trade. Connecting the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans, the canal is considered one of the seven wonders of the modern world. But the country is not only a passage for thousands of ships transporting goods from east to west. Panama is also a key transit point for thousands of migrants and asylum seekers going from south to north. When neighboring Colombia opened its borders in May after lifting some of the COVID-19 restrictions, thousands of men, women, and even children from the region and beyond arrived at the Colombia-Panama border. They risk it all crossing Panama's perilous jungle in a desperate journey searching for protection and better opportunities in the US and Canada. And as the scale of international migration is on the rise, how is Panama coping with the current crisis at its border? Panama's foreign minister, Erika Moines, talks to Al Jazeera.
Foreign minister, thank you for talking to Al Jazeera. There's thousands of people that are migrating from South America, from countries like Haiti, Cuba, heading to Colombia, then Panama, going to Central America, and the objective is North America. Why do you think this amount of people are moving right now? How many people are actually heading and coming towards Panama?
The migration phenomenon, it is the phenomenon of our times, of the 21st century. In Panama, in particular, we've seen the ups and downs of this type of migration specifically. We've tried to raise awareness of it for significant time now. In 2015, we had a peak, including 2016, and now it seems that it's building up to what it could be very soon, a humanitarian crisis again. The migration that we're dealing with is a different type of migration. There is already significant attention on the Northern Triangle migration, so the ones that are migrating from Honduras, Nicaragua, Guatemala, going towards the north. And then there has been in the past a focus on the Venezuelan migration and the exodus that happened given the political situation there. However, the meeting that we're convening and the awareness that we're trying to raise within the international community is for this very specific migration that is mostly from the Caribbean and then some from Africa, extracontinental to us, that arrive by air to the south in certain countries, and then they make their way up to United States mostly. About less than 1% of those migrants request asylum or refugee. We've already tried to re-socialize them to get them interested in staying. We have a very distinct humanitarian approach towards that type of migration. We not only have prepared migration stations from the years preceding that already we had to deal with this, so we are equipped to manage a controlled flow of migration. And the phenomenon of migration, we have to understand, we're not going to be able to stop it. There are significant and difficult root causes in each of the countries. But to the extent that we can understand what's happening and agree among ourselves, the originating countries, the ones that receive them, and the ones that the passageways, such as Panama, such as Costa Rica, Colombia, and as well as the destination countries, could make a significant impact, not only in how many we're receiving, but the type of support and aid that we're able to provide them.
You have been very active in trying to talk to other countries involved in this migration. What would you like to see happen? A humanitarian corridor? That's something I've heard you say. I mean, how would you implement something like this?
The first thing is, it has to be a humanitarian approach. These are people that need our support. Nobody chooses to be a migrant. Those are external causes. It is very difficult. There are heartbreaking stories that you hear about the families, the children that go through this process, and a lot of people that are taking advantage of their situation. Going through the routes that they go, it can't happen without somebody orchestrating where they go and profiting from this route. So what do we want? We want first, with that humanitarian approach, to make sure that everybody is following the same standards that we have in terms of care for the migrants. We do the health checkups. Those health checkups should be happening in every single country where they're going through. The support in terms of food, in terms of, for instance, for specifically for mothers or for children, they need special food and nourishment. And when they come here, they are severely dehydrated, malnourished, and it is a situation that, to the extent that is not only Panama, but the rest of the countries contributing and supporting these migrants, that we would be better equipped to serve. The second one, in order to support migration, it has to be controlled. It can't get out of control. And this is not just to this continent. If you see it in other continents, it is the same situation where if it goes uncontrolled and unchecked, it becomes a problem.
Are there any differences on how countries in the region, on how to cope with what's happening? I mean, are there differences with Costa Rica, with Nicaragua, with Colombia? I mean, how do you find a common ground on how to cope with the ongoing situation?
Well, there is a different response from each of the countries. And I would start by saying Panama is the only country that not only doesn't charge them, because when they go to each of these countries, they get charged. The migrants get charged for entering the country. So not only we not charge them, but we provide the support. Panama is a very small country. If we are able to do it, that means that every other country should be doing their part and should be able to manage. We should not be seeing scenes where there's massive confusion and where they don't have a place to stay, or they're not properly treated, or even get the minimum health checkups as they're required. Now, there are different approaches depending on your situation regarding the migration. There are countries that are receiving them because they're going by air. They don't arrive in Panama. They are not arriving in Mexico, for instance. They're arriving in the south in distinct countries that allow for them to arrive. There is the second one, which is the countries that are sort of the passage for this type of migration, and they deal with different situation than the ones receiving. And then there are the destiny countries. The number one, as we all know, is the United States, and we think that they should also look towards this type of migration, considering that the number one nationality crossing their south border is related to this type of migration.
Is there pressure from countries like the U.S. or Canada to try to prevent the migrants from because in the end, where they're going is to the United States and Canada. I mean, have you been pressured, or you know, if there is, you know, attempts to try to control the flow?
No, we have not been pressured. And I think right now the main focus of attention has been the Northern Triangle migration. I think that there has been, which we think is positive at the end, every type of migration should be dealt with ideally from the root causes, so that you're helping what is creating the concern or the need to migrate, rather than just control it or try to block it. They do benefit, as Mexico and even as all the other countries, because if you think about it, I don't know, Honduras or Nicaragua or all the countries where they have their own migrants going towards the U.S., they're also receiving this type of migration. So this is an added consideration or problem on top of the one that they're already facing. So I think it benefits on multiple fronts to try to confront the situation and to come up with a more holistic approach in terms of solution, one that is sustainable, not something sort of one-off, block or not block or deal, but rather something that is sustainable. Again, as I mentioned, I think that the migration, it's a phenomenon of our times that we need to deal with in sort of a more frontal approach.
We're passing on to the region. The pandemic has generated lots of tension across the world, but we're seeing a lot of that tension in Latin America. We're seeing protests in Colombia. We're seeing protests in Cuba, in countries that are ruled by the right and in countries that are ruled by the left. What do you think is going on?
Well, at the end, and I think it goes back to the same causes for migration, regardless where you sit, the right, the left, the center, there is a humanitarian problem. One driven by poverty, by the economic situation, and that we can deal with regardless of where you sit in the political spectrum. And we should look for more areas of cooperation and not be limiting our support or not depending on the particular approach of the government. Haiti, for instance, one of the number one nationalities that we see here in the migration, got vaccines, the first dose of vaccines maybe 10 days ago. That's unthinkable and untenable if you consider the situation, what they're going. So we all need to do our part and support and solidarity towards the conditions that are happening and trying to, at the very least, have a very humane and humanitarian approach to dealing with this situation such that we don't end up with the problems that or the sort of the peaks and crises that we're seeing now.
When you see this amount of people taking to the streets protesting, do you think governments in the region are under pressure, that people are demanding change in a way? What do you think? You're an expert on politics in general. I mean, I'm interested in your analysis on how do you see the region as a whole with what's going on?
I think that our region, it's fairly complicated at the moment. It's fairly convoluted as it is. And we are not also acting as a bloc. We stopped doing that almost a decade ago, which is unfortunate. And if I go back to an example, for instance, on the vaccine, you saw the European Union negotiating as a bloc. Now the African League may do some of that. You don't see the Latin American region coming together, and we should. We should unite ourselves and understand that the challenges that are presented in front of us, we can't continue acting alone, but we need to come together again and understand, regardless of the political situation, that there are bigger challenges. Climate action, it's something, again, that you cannot deal with alone. Yet, Central America, for instance, is one of the top regions affected by climate. Why we're not doing something together, why we're not acting or collaborating more in solutions that do not continue with this cycle of poverty where a country recovers from a hurricane and the money that should be directed towards helping poverty ends up just recovery process for the disaster that the hurricane causes.
One of the divisive issues in the region is, for example, what's happening in Nicaragua and in Venezuela. You know, Panama is part of the Lima Group, and they've been pushing for elections in Venezuela specifically. What do you think has been the result? I mean, what's your opinion on what's happening now, not only in Venezuela, on what the approach has been to try to solve the crisis there?
Yeah, I think that the approach that we've had so far on the Venezuelan crisis has not been successful. And the sooner that we come to terms with that reality and we say we can't do more of the same because it's not having any consequences, it has not had any meaningful impact, the sooner that we'll start making or going around alternative approaches that could drive change. And I think the same sort of frustration we share when it goes to Nicaragua, because it's the international community being tested once again, and how we react towards it and what we do as a community, we can't fail again. We've already had that situation in the past, so we need to, again, come together and try to, with meaningful approaches that have a concrete impact such that we don't end up in the same situation.
What would be the alternative? Because it's, you know, so we see the Lima Group, the sanctions, etc., and even the Biden administration, they're considering like different approaches. I mean, do you see a third option that is not the one that's been dealt until now?
Well, I think that sometimes we are quick to look for very aggressive statements and sign up to all these statements and publicize them. And the true impact of those statements, we've seen it so far. Whether you have a statement from one country or two countries or 20 countries, it's not going to drive change. We advocate for trying to generate dialogue, to try to push the needle a little bit further, to make sure that there is as much as inclusiveness in terms of the political parties, observation and the electoral process, et cetera. So trying to, it may not be from one day to the other, but maybe that's never gonna happen. And we need to push at least for some change. So little by little, we accomplish and we look towards a new future that we need for these countries.
What's your opinion on the OAS, on the Organization of American States? I mean, do you still see it as a organization that can force agreements between countries? Would you like to see other organizations being created? I mean, because definitely there is need for more cooperation, I mean, in the region to transform what's going on right now.
Yeah, there is more need, and again, I think I go back to the same principles. Sort of during the pandemic, the amount of death that were in our region and cases does not conform with the population. We were one of the hardest hit regions in the world, yet we're not doing anything different. With the vaccine situation, the same. With the climate action, again, hardest hit, yet we're not able to come to terms. So there is clearly a need for better cooperation and trying to maybe take it to remove the political dialogue a little bit and focus on the main and core issues that should be at the top priority for every single foreign policy within our region is key. And hopefully we can start then with the challenges that we have in front of us. If we haven't realized that by now, then the future is not bright for our region.
The pandemic has had a major impact on the economy in the region. What would you like to see happen in the future? Do you think that there is a before and after, that this is a time to change, you know, how Latin American economies, how Panama's economy is going to move forward?
I certainly think that this is a key time, a key moment to do things different, because we've just, it's evidence that what we've been doing isn't enough, and it has just shown how much of the differences in terms of inequality exists within our region. So if we are continuing to do the same, we're certainly in the wrong path. Now, what do we do different? I'll take, for example, the issue of women empowerment and equality. You hear in all the speeches, women in power, we believe in that, in equality. Yet, this is the moment where that speech could be transformed into action, because this is the first time in recent history where most of the public policy or the economy of each country is driven by the state. Every single country depends on the state mostly, and not only the private sector driving the force, because we're all recovering from this pandemic. We've all gone into massive debt, et cetera. So it is the time where you can say, okay, if I believe in women, I can put them at the top of the agenda and say, for instance, tax credits specifically for women, work incentives, et cetera. So everything that we've sort of dealt with and say, this is what I would like to happen, this is the time, because whatever each government decides to put at the top of the agenda, it could drive meaningful change.
Important countries like China and the United States have increased their presence in Latin America, increasing investment in Latin America. What do you think of that?
Our approach towards China has been, China is an economic superpower, superhouse that we can neglect. given the Panama Canal that we have. So we, while we have a relatively young diplomatic relation, given the Panama Canal, our economy that is dependent on commerce, we look to strengthen that type of cooperation and increase to make sure that we are developing with commerce and everything where they are interesting as well. However, our strongest economic and strategic ally has always been the U.S., and that will continue to be the case. So our role when we see this clashes between powerhouses is to step back. We remain neutral. It is not our place to be in the midst of what one might say or the other. We stand back. We are extremely neutral. We have successfully maintained that position throughout our times, and is now more important than ever for Panama to remain and to have their separate relation with each of these economics.
That was my question. No? Panama is such a small country, and it's in the middle, in a way, in the tension that exists today between the United States and China. You know, how do you handle that tension? I mean, do you find moments where, you know, how do you keep the balance?
I think that we've been fairly successful in removing ourselves from the subject matters that cause the tension and not stay in the middle. I think in the past, or certain countries try to look for one or the other. We don't think that's our place. It's not what we've done in the past and not what has been successful for Panama. And we think that we'll continue in that same route of having our separate relation and removing ourselves from every area that causes tension among themselves.
And one last question. Panama is known to be, in a way, a tax haven, or perceived as such around the world. And it seems now that the world is changing. They're trying to increase corporate tax around the world, a minimum corporate tax. How do you adapt?
Yeah, we are not a tax haven. We are perceived as one, but when you look into the specifics, there is no bank secrecy in Panama. There is no area where you can hide your assets, and the information will not be shared with whatever country you come from. In fact, most countries share the information with 10, with 12, with 30 countries. We share the information with 72 countries, which means that every single of our banks goes through the list of whoever has money here and makes sure that whoever you are national from, the information is sent. So we've suffered in the past from unfortunate scandals that had very little to do with Panama itself. But we've sort of turned the page, and we've been extremely committed, probably going above and beyond. And a simple example would be that out of the over 750,000 corporations that we have in Panama, we deregister half of those. So over 300 of those corporations were deregistered to make sure to the minimum, if there was no complying, even a minimum of the requirements. No other country in the world has ever done taken such a bold step to sort of clear their name and make sure that we're known for what we are, for the standards that we have, the KYC, the AML compliances that our banks have. People come here to try to open bank accounts, and they end up leaving and going to very well-known jurisdiction and important economies because they're not able to open the bank account here. They are somewhere else. So I think that we are extremely proud and are trying to shine more light into the standards and protocols because, as you say, we're only interested in good investment, which at the end turns and multiplies into more and positive investment. We are interested, we want good investment that we can trace back, investment that will stay here, that will create more economic opportunities for Panamanians, and we want to be known as a beacon for transparency around the world.
Thank you very much. Thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
Thank you. Bye-bye.